cookies, and more. Catering services are also available. World Harvest encourages you to join them in supporting public radio.
We're broadcasting from Campbell Hall for Public Telecommunication, thanks to the generosity of University of Illinois alumni Alice and Robert Campbell.
This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. It's hour two of our show. I'm David Inge. Our producers are Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal. The following program comes from the Focus 580 archive, so that means for the next hour, we'll not be taking your calls. Human beings, for a long time now, have studied animals and animal behavior as a way of trying to get a better understanding of humans and human behavior. And so it is appealing to look at our closest relatives in the animal kingdom, the primates, study their behavior, and then ask some basic questions about their behavior and our own. And if you do that, for example, if you take a look at one of our closest primate relatives, the chimpanzee, you see here an animal that can be aggressive, vicious, manipulative. And if you think that's basically what human beings are like, then you might be tempted to argue that that is somehow in our nature to be vicious and manipulative. However, we have another close relative that is similar to the chimpanzee, although perhaps not quite as well known for people outside the field of primatology, and this is the bonobo. And it is a very different animal than the chimpanzee. It is an animal that, while on the one hand the chimps can be vicious and manipulative, bonobos are very gentle and loving. And if you think that's naturally how human beings are, you might be tempted to say, well, that is in our nature, and we can point to another animal that's close to us and is like that. So then the question becomes, well, which is it? Which is the better model for human beings? Which one tells us more about what we are really like? Well, that is the question that we will discuss this morning in this part of Focus 580 with a man who is well known for his work on the social intelligence of primates, like chimpanzees and bonobos and others. His name is Franz de Waal. He's a biologist and ethologist. He's currently the C.H. Chandler Professor in the Psychology Department at Emory University. He is also director of the Living Links Center at the Yerkes Primate Center in Atlanta and is the author of a number of books and has a new one out, which is entitled Our Inner Ape. The subtitle is A Leading Primatologist Explains Why We Are, Who We Are. It is published by Riverhead Books. Professor de Waal, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us today.
Yeah, glad to be there.
We certainly appreciate it. Just, I suppose, as a question to start out with, I suppose some people would say that would raise this question about using chimpanzees or bonobos as a kind of a model or a way to think about human behavior. Even though they are close to us genetically, they are different in a lot of other ways. Just how good a model are they? How close are we?
Well, we're all primates. The primate order has 200 species, and then within the primate order, there's basically five animals. If we call humans animals, there's basically five species that are very close, which are the four great ape species, gorillas, orangutans, chimpanzees, and bonobos, and us. And that's a very tight little family, and as you know, probably, the DNA of a chimpanzee or bonobo is 98.5% identical to ours. So we're extremely close. The split between us and them is probably 5 million years ago. So we're talking about species that are as close as, let's say, a horse and a zebra or something like that, even closer than that, extremely close in biological terms.
Perhaps you could talk a little bit in very basic ways about the two animals, the chimpanzee and the bonobo. The one people will be at least a little bit more familiar with, they will have heard of it. And I think that perhaps some people will have heard of the bonobo, but relatively speaking, it's a recent discovery. So there might be some people for whom this is new, that they've never even heard of a bonobo before.
Yeah, the bonobo used to be mixed up, actually, in science with the chimpanzee, and zoos would display bonobos as chimpanzees at some point in time, but they are now distinguished as a separate species. They are exactly equally close to us as the chimpanzee, but their behavior is extremely different, given how close the two of them are, chimps and bonobos. And so it's very interesting to compare us with the two of them instead of just with the chimpanzee. because the chimpanzee is far better known, and that's usually what the comparisons are made with. The bonobo is different physically also. The bonobo is more elegant, has longer legs relative to its body, and the bonobo has very different vocalizations than the chimpanzee. They live in a different area. They live in what is now ironically called the Democratic Republic of the Congo, and that's where they are restricted in Africa. And so the bonobo is fairly easy, if you know the species, fairly easy to distinguish from the chimpanzee, and behaviorally very different. The bonobo is more like a sort of primate hippie. It's a happy-go-lucky, not very aggressive, very sexy, relatively peaceful. For example, just to give one point of data, we have many instances of chimpanzees killing each other, either killing infants of their own species or killing each other in territorial warfare. There are many, and at zoos there are many examples also of chimpanzees killing each other. There's not a single observation, as far as I know, of any bonobo killing another bonobo. So that's right there, an enormous data point to compare the two.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. I think you speculate on how the fact that the chimpanzee is better known had been studied by science for a long time. This sort of basic qualities, this kind of personality, had been identified. You speculate that the fact that was the one we became familiar with first, and the bonobo later, that may indeed have had a powerful effect on the way we think about basic human nature. Certainly, there was a lot back in the 60s. There was a lot of stuff written about this that basically made this argument that human beings were fundamentally aggressive, violent in our nature. And to underpin that argument, they took a look at primate behavior. But it was, you know, then they asked this question was, well, wouldn't it have been interesting if, in fact, the bonobo was the one that we had studied first? And then later we came along on the chimpanzee.
Yeah. We have a general tendency in the West to blame bad things that humans do on our animal nature. So if we commit genocide or if we leave people behind after a hurricane, we say we're acting like animals. And so when the word animal is used, it's usually for something bad that we have done. And so we have already that general tendency. And then after World War II, there was so much focus on aggressive behavior for obvious reasons. That became the main issue. Conrad Lawrence wrote about it, Robert Ardrey wrote about it, and so on. And then when the chimpanzee came along and Jane Goodall discovered in the field that they have territorial warfare and they sometimes kill each other, it all fit together. We are aggressive animals. Chimpanzees are our close relatives. They are aggressive animals. And so since the 60s, we've been bombarded with views of how aggressive we are, how we are also selfish. The selfish gene came along. So we're basically nasty creatures. That was the message that we got out of biology. And the bonobo didn't fit that message. And that's why the bonobo was sort of sidelined, because it was very soon evident that the bonobo was far more peaceful, more sexy than the bonobo. And the anthropologists really didn't know what to do with the bonobo. And so their main message became like, the chimpanzee is the model that we should use, and the bonobo we can just ignore. And I'm arguing in my book that the bonobo is exactly equally close to us as the chimpanzee. There's absolutely no reason to act as if they don't exist. And we should deal with that. And we have actually a lot of empathic and friendly and peaceful tendencies in the human species as well. And that's where the bonobo is a sort of interesting comparison.
Mm-hmm. And you obviously the fundamental argument that you're making in the book is that if one asks this question, well, what are we more like? What is fundamental human nature more like? Are we more like chimpanzees? Are we more like bonobos? You're saying, well, we're both. We're a combination of both. We have both of those in our behaviors. We show both of those characteristics, both of those sort of patterns. We can be one or the other. We in effect, are both. So it's not so much a choice if we have to say we are one or the other, but that we're some blending, or at least that we can go either way.
Yeah, I call us bipolar apes in the sense that when we are bad, we are worse than any animal that I know. Because we torture and we rape and we kill on a massive scale. So we're actually worse than chimpanzees. But if we are good, we're better than any animal that I know, and because we have a very high level of empathy and sympathy. Of course, we're very selective in these things in the sense that we apply that more within the group than between groups. And the within group and between group distinction is a very important one for us, because outside of the group we do sort of random killing sometimes, but inside of the group that's prohibited. And so in that sense, we have both natures. Within the group, we are nicer than towards outsiders. But you can see that same sort of thing in chimpanzees and bonobos as well. And for example, chimpanzees are certainly far more cooperative within the group than they are between groups.
Mm-hmm. And would be certainly likely to show aggression to someone who is an outsider. How do bonobos do that? How do bonobos react to strangers? There's others of their species, but not of their group.
Well, that's interesting, because in the field they have observed that when bonobo groups meet, they go through a phase of some threatening and chasing, so there is tension between them, and they are territorial, and sometimes there's even fighting between them. But very soon thereafter, they start doing what is called mingling. They have sex with the members of the opposite group, the females with the males, but also the females with the females, because bonobos are very bisexual. So the sex going on, and then they start grooming, and then very soon the kids will be playing with each other between different groups. And before you know it, it looks more like a picnic than like warfare. And that's completely different from the chimpanzee. In the chimpanzee, there are no friendly relationships between group. And bonobos, that's a possibility. So there you see right away that also in their dealings between groups, they're quite different from the chimpanzee.
Let me again just to quickly introduce the guest for anyone who might have tuned in the last few minutes. Frans de Waal is a biologist and ethologist. He is well known for his work on the social intelligence of primates like chimpanzees and bonobos. He is currently the C.H. Chandler Professor in the Psychology Department of Emory University. He's also director of the Living Links Center at the Yerkes Primate Center in Atlanta. He is the author of altogether 6 books, and his newest explores this territory here we're talking about. It's entitled Our Inner Ape, A Leading Primatologist Explains Why We Are Who We Are. That's the subtitle, and it's published by Riverhead and is in the bookstore now. And if you want to read it, you can do that. And here, if you want to call in with questions or comments, you can do that too. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I'm interested in perhaps again having you, you know, maybe you might talk a little bit more about the bonobo, just again, because I think to some people this might be new, or they might have heard of these animals but might not be terribly familiar with them. I mean, you talk a little bit more about if culture is the appropriate word to use, and I don't know if that's if it is what bonobo culture is like.
Yeah, culture is usually a term that we use for behavior that is learned from that animals learn from each other. And actually, the difference between bonobos and chimpanzees are real species differences. They're not necessarily learned. Part of it is biological. So, for example, the use of sex for resolution of conflict, which bonobos do a lot, they're sort of the make-love-not-war primates, that is universal at zoos, and it's universal in the field as far as we know. So that's really a species difference, and bonobos do that on a large scale. So bonobos are, as I said, a bit more elegant. They used to be called pygmy chimpanzees, which is a misnomer because they are not much smaller. They're actually the same size as the smallest subspecies of chimpanzee. There are very few of them in captivity. The nearest place for you would be Milwaukee. And Milwaukee Zoo has maybe 10% of the world population of bonobos, because there's only 150 of them altogether in the whole world in captivity, whereas we have thousands of chimpanzees in captivity. So the bonobo is in captivity very rare. In the field, it's highly endangered and very hard to access because there's so much warfare going on in the DRC. And so we know much less about bonobos than we do about chimpanzees, and there's only a handful of people who focus on the bonobo. Mm-hmm.
So what you're saying is that these kind of patterns of behavior are hardwired in the animals. They're something that these behaviors are expressed in a natural sort of way. They're kind of there. Mm-hmm. They come with the animal. And I don't know if it's possible to answer a question like this, but given the fact that here we have two species that are genetically at least very, very similar, and yet show these very different behaviors. How is there any way of accounting for that? I'm sure that people have perhaps at least tried to think about why that should be, that they should in some ways be so similar and yet in their behaviors that they should be so different.
Well, there are speculations about why bonobos evolved the way they are. One important hypothesis is that their forest is richer. They have no competition of gorillas, whereas chimpanzees overlap with gorillas. Gorillas eat a lot of the forest floor type foods, and bonobos have all the food for themselves. And in addition, they live in a richer type forest. And as a result of that, the females can travel together. So the female bonobos are not forced to disperse, as is the case with chimpanzee females, who cannot find enough food if they would be in a group. And so the female bonobos travel as a group and have very strong bonds among themselves, which allows them to form the alliance which makes it possible for females to dominate males. So in bonobo society, the females are in charge, and they are in charge collectively. It's not that individual female can dominate an individual male because she is smaller than the male, but collectively the females can do that. And so one of the explanations of why the bonobos are so different has to do with ecology. Another explanation has to do with using sex for non-reproductive reasons, which they started doing and which maybe was very beneficial in their society.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting. It makes me think of a recent conversation, and now, unfortunately, I can't recall the guest, but we were talking about a book that looked at the question of instinct and when what we mean by instinct and where, you know, why is it, looking at this basic question of why is it that particular animals exhibit characteristic behaviors that are characteristic of them and their species, and that we have this way of saying, well, it is hardwired. And I think he was really making a strong argument that while in fact that's true, that you cannot ignore the interaction between the individual and the environment, and that in fact, yes, certain animals might be primed for certain behaviors, but if you don't put them in the right environment for those behaviors to be expressed, they won't be. So again, it was sort of he was taking the middle position in the old nature-nurture controversy.
That's, of course, typical, is that we who study animal behavior, we don't even want to talk about instincts anymore, because the word instinct gives the impression that it's genetically fixed and that nothing can be done about it. I think humans don't have instincts in that sense. And primates like chimpanzees and bonobos don't. I actually don't look at us as more or less biologically programmed than a chimpanzee, because there's an enormous amount of flexibility, and the apes are adult when they're 16 or so. So there's an enormous amount of learning that goes into their behavior, an enormous amount of education, actually, in a certain sense, that they get from their group. There are all these cultural differences, and yes, you're right. There is no behavior. You cannot think of anything, aggression, peacemaking, sexual behavior. There is no behavior that is not affected by the environment. And so instinct is a term that we don't like to use too much anymore.
Well, let's talk with some callers there. We have a couple here waiting, and they're both in Urbana, so we'll go first to line number one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I wonder if you could say how you say that bonobos are genetically similar to chimpanzees. From a DNA point of view, what percent of the DNA is similar, and what estimates would you have as to how long ago they diverged from each other? Was it the same as, say, 5 million years like humans from the other great apes?
Yeah, I don't think I know the figure of how genetically similar bonobos are to chimpanzees, but of course that percentage should be higher than between us and them, because their split is supposed to have occurred only 2 or 2.5 million years ago.
I see.
So the first split is between us and their lineage, and then a split occurred between them. And the big debate that we have actually is which species is more like the last common ancestor? There was an ancestral type who was most likely more ape-like than human-like, because we probably changed more in the meantime. So an ape-like ancestor who may have been chimp-like or bonobo-like. Now, usually the experts on chimpanzees, they say it was a chimp-like creature, and the experts on bonobos, they say it was a bonobo-like creature, because we all want to have the ancestral type, so to speak. But we really don't have any knowledge about it, and the only piece of evidence that we got very recently was a study that came out on DNA research on humans, chimps, and bonobos, where they found a small piece of DNA that is involved in affiliation and bonding, and that is present in the bonobo and in the human, but is absent in the chimpanzee. And so that makes me think that in terms of the social inclinations, at least related to bonding and affiliation, the last common ancestor may have been more bonobo-like, which is not the predominant view, because most people don't even want to hear about bonobos because they disturb the sort of aggressive scenarios that they have built about human evolution.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, thank you. And I think that goes to a question that I was going to sort of wedge in here, that in as much as we were talking a little bit earlier about the fact that human beings and our behavior can show, we can be like chimpanzees or like bonobos. We can show both that range of behavior. And mm-hmm. and so you're saying, I think you had this nice turn of phrase that we were the human beings are the bipolar ape,
mm-hmm.
because we can go either way. But I'm sure that there are people who would say to you, okay, Dr. DeWall, really, not can now level with me. We're really more like one or the other, aren't we? I'm sure people still want it. They don't want the middle. They want to know one way or another.
Yeah, they want a simple solution to a complex problem. And yes, there are people who want the last common ancestor to be more bonobo-like. There's a sort of wishful thinking in there because the bonobo is peaceful and is bisexual and is female-dominated. So you can see how certain people like the gay community or the feminist community, they love the bonobo. The bonobo is very popular. Mm-hmm. But I think this issue will probably be resolved in the coming 10 or 15 years by genetic research. Like the little piece of evidence that I gave, I don't think it's going to be the last piece of evidence. It's only the first one. So at some point we can probably resolve that. But at this point, I think we have inclinations of both, because very obviously we are an aggressive territorial animal, like the chimpanzee. And also very obviously we have pro-social and friendly tendencies like the bonobo. And I really think that we unify in ourselves very conflicting tendencies, and we have a very complex nature, actually.
Well, let's talk with someone else. I think we have another caller in Urbana. This is line number two. Hello.
Oh, hi, how are you?
Yes.
Really interesting. The bonobo, you talk about their pacific, you know, their pacific behavior versus the chimpanzee. Now, are you saying that, in a sense, that these are gene-driven, and that because of the subtle difference you said you saw in the genetic code, that pacifying behavior could be like gene driven? Is that what you're sort of telling us?
I'm not sure. I think there may be lower testosterone. That's a speculation that people have in the bonobo male, at least. And that could, of course, be partly genetic. I have no idea of how to separate genetic and environmental influences,
yeah.
And I think no one has that idea.
Yeah, I'm wondering because, you know, these genomes are being sequenced now, and like I remember when the human genome was sequenced, I read somewhere a paper that there were 200 complete bacterial genomes in the human genome that had been carried through the history of the genome. Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering if that sort of data fits with your studies of the bonobo DNA and chimpanzee DNA. I mean, as it might be influences on genetic changes. I'm not sure. I mean, I don't think there's anybody knows what this means. But I'm also interested in the fact that when we look, I think you're right about the genetic components. But I'm wondering if more of what we are is gene-driven. I know people want to argue that as a eugenics thing, which I don't. I think that was, you know, those ideas were precursors to the knowledge of the genome. But I'm wondering if this, as you said, there are 98% similarity between human genetic makeup and these chimpanzees, and it just shows me the incredible subtlety. I know the numbers are higher if you break down the millions of sequences. But, I mean, the subtlety of genes is so interesting to me because, I mean, look how we parted, whatever, millions or hundreds of thousands or millions of years ago. We're us, and these animals are those, or them, or whatever. And I'm just fascinated by that. Can you comment on that?
Yeah, let me qualify that statement. Mm-hmm. When I said that we are genetically 98.5% mm-hmm. identical to mm-hmm. chimps and bonobos, that is a way of indicating how extremely close we are as mm-hmm. species. But then immediately I should add that we are also genetically 50% identical to bananas.
Yeah.
Meaning that there is a lot of genes that code for very basic things like oxygen absorption or whatever it is, things that, that all plants and animals need to do. Or for example, if you look at mammals, we have hearts, livers, kidneys. We have an enormous amount in common that we take for granted, which we have in common with a mouse, we have in common with a cat.
Yeah.
And genes are programming all of that. And so that's the first comment I need to make, is that there's a vast majority of genes doing things that we are really not interested in when we compare ourselves with the apes. And then the 1.5% that we are different with chimps and bonobos, that could be a very powerful 1.5%. It may actually be regulatory genes that have effect on the expression of other genes, and if that's the case, we should actually count them more heavily than just your average kind of gene. And so I'm not a geneticist, and I cannot specify these things, and I don't think anyone can specify these things at this point, but it is obvious that that figure of 98.5% needs to be taken with a grain of salt if you compare two species.
Yeah, well, when you're saying about the bananas and the similar, that's just the commonality of all life forms.
Yes, yes.
I mean, then you follow evolution back, assuming you can actually, you can do that, but I mean, that's what's interesting about this, is that this, all this intelligent designer stuff that's out in the you know, public venue, people don't understand that the commonality of, you keep going back and back and back. Oh, like the analogy would be the Big Bang. Everything originated in the Big Bang, right?
Yep.
So everything is sort of an origin point. But I want to say one other thing. Years and years ago, a comedian said, in reference to, you know, like this argument over apes and man, he said, well, humans were just monkeys with car keys. And I always thought that was so sort of like, said the whole thing. We're apes, we're hominids and all that stuff, but, you know, we just drive.
Well, that's usually what I say. And I usually say that Darwin did not go far enough when he said we descend from the apes, because I consider us basically apes. We are apes on two legs with large brains, and so I'm not saying that we're not special. I think I consider us very special, but we are basically apes.
Well, yeah, and that's also, you know, self-serving too. I mean, I agree, we're special. Thanks a lot. I really appreciate it.
Yeah. Okay.
All right. Thanks for the call. Well, I think this is all interesting in the respect that, on the one hand, it seems that we're really fascinated by the higher primates because we can sometimes see echoes of ourselves there. And in fact, there can be something almost disturbing about the primate gaze when you look in the face of this animal, because you end up asking a lot of questions about who is this? Who are they and who am I?
Well, wait a second. You need to ask yourself, why is that disturbing? To me, it's not disturbing. But I know that many people find that disturbing. And I think what happens is that we are raised in a culture where everyone tells us we are different. We are not animals. Animals is something else. We are humans. Then you, in the zoo, you walk up to, let's say, a gorilla or a chimpanzee, and you look them in the eyes, and all of a sudden, that doctrine that we learn at school and that we learn everywhere, that we are different, falls apart right in front of us, because we're staring in the eye of a personality that is just as strong a personality as we are. It only has hair on its body and everything, and so it's slightly different, but most of it is similar. And I think the reason we find the gaze of an ape so disturbing is because deep down we all of a sudden realize that there was just a story that they're telling us, that we're different from animals. We are basically animals. And so it creates a dissonance in us. And that's why people also start laughing when they see apes. They become nervous and they start making jokes. And they try to get over that disturbing feeling by making the biggest jokes about how stupid those animals look, but actually they look so similar to us that we get nervous about it.
Yeah, I think that's an important point that you make, and in as much as we might be interested in them and make these tentative sort of send out these tentative feelers about how we are alike, that in fact, down deep, we're disturbed by the idea that we are alike. Mm-hmm. We don't want to admit the fact that human beings are animals, and that indeed there may not be that all that much that separates us from particularly these animals that are in so many ways so close to us. We are a little bit past the midpoint here. Perhaps I should introduce again our guest, Franz de Waal. He's a biologist and an ethologist. He's well known for his work on the social intelligence of primates like chimpanzees and bonobos, the animals here we've been talking a bit about here this morning. He is currently the C.H. Chandler Professor in the Psychology Department of Emory University and director of the Living Link Center at the Yerkes Primate Center in Atlanta. He's the author of a number of books, and his most recent is titled Our Inner Ape, and it is published by Riverhead Books, which is a member of the Penguin Group, and it is out now in the bookstore if you want to take a look at it. Any questions, comments are certainly welcome. 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. One of the things that I think people always are, they may not really admit it or not, but they seem to be interested in and preoccupied with when it comes to the bonobo is sexual behavior. Mm-hmm. And maybe not surprising that we would, on the one hand, we are fascinated with it, and on the other hand, it's another one of those things we're fascinated with, but also makes us uncomfortable. Why do you think that it is in terms of the sort of the various kinds of social glues that hold groups of individuals together, that in this particular case of this species, that sexual behavior is so important?
Yeah, we have speculations about that. Is that infanticide, or the killing of infants, is a common problem in many animals. It's actually also a problem in human society. It occurs as well. And so it's usually a male activity. It happens in bears, in lions, in many birds, in many primates. Males, when they take over a group, they kill young infants. And the thinking is that they do that partly in order to get the females fertile sooner so that they can fertilize those females and have their own offspring with them instead of somebody else's offspring. So there is a whole list of theories about infanticide. And what we think the bonobo female has done, compared to the chimpanzee where infanticide occurs, and bonobo has never been observed, the bonobo female has done is two things. One is become dominant over the males collectively, which is, of course, a very good inhibitor of that kind of behavior, because the females will collectively also protect their offspring then against males. And the second is to have so much sex with everybody that no one knows anymore whose offspring is whose. And so they create what is called paternity uncertainty. So males cannot exclude certain infants from their aggressive behavior, which they should do. Of course, they should exclude their own offspring from their aggressive behavior. And so males are sort of confused as far as paternity is concerned, and that inhibits their sort of infanticidal behavior. And so out of that came a lot of other sex that the bonobo is probably performing, and so people have speculated that what the bonobo female is doing with her extensive sexual activity is create an environment in which infanticide is less common. Mm-hmm. And actually, it has never been observed. So it's maybe they have eliminated it, which would be really drastic.
Mm. I think probably one of the key things that, again, when people study animal behavior, and perhaps, again, it's because of our concerns about conflict, one of the key things that people hone in on is conflict resolution. Mm-hmm. And this is something I know that you're interested in. And here again, we look at these two different species, we see very different patterns of dealing with conflict.
Yeah, but the basic principle is the same across all the primates. So the basic principle is that two individuals have a fight over whatever, food or mates or dominance or whatever the reason is, and then afterwards they come together, and for example, chimpanzees, they kiss and embrace after a fight as a reconciliation, or monkeys, they often groom each other as a reconciliation, or bonobos, they have sex. But the principle is always the same, is that there is a relationship that is damaged. The relationship has value because it's, for example, used for cooperation or for a coalition or for family relationships. And so the relationship has value, and they have to undo the damage that they did to it. And reconciliation is a big topic now in animal research, and actually we found it also outside of the primates. It has been found in dolphins and in hyenas. In all the animals that have cooperative relationships, you're going to find reconciliation behavior.
Let's talk with another caller. This is someone listening in Mattoon on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. If I could, I have a couple of questions. One, I hope I'm not asking something I missed a few minutes, but where do they fit in to the relative intelligence with the other primates? And also, not to take the subject far afield, but I've always been really fascinated with baboon behavior, and I'm wondering how baboons and their socialization and their structure fit into the whole primate thing in regards to chimps and the other apes and such.
Okay, now baboons used to be very popular as models for human evolution. This was in the 60s and 70s. And the reasoning there was that baboons have invaded an environment, the savanna, which we also invaded. And so ecologically, there's a lot of similarity between us and them. And so baboons became, at some point, the most popular model for human evolution. But baboons, are, of course, since they're monkeys, are quite a bit more distant from us than are the apes. And baboons, there's a whole bunch of things that baboons don't do. So, for example, food sharing, tool use, cultural transmission, all these things that are stressed in chimpanzees are either absent or very little developed in the baboon. And also because of the evolutionary distance, the baboon was dropped in the 80s and 90s and replaced by the chimpanzee as main model for human evolution. And now I'm, of course, arguing that the chimpanzee is fine, but you should pull in the bonobo just as well if you want to make a full-blown comparison between us and the apes. As far as intelligence, I rate all the apes very similarly. I know that some people say, for example, that gorillas are not as smart as the other three. I have no reason to believe that, and actually recently reports have come out of the wild of gorillas using tools, and so the gorilla is back in business as far as intelligence is concerned. And I think I rate them very similarly, but temperamentally they're very different. So, for example, the orangutan is more patient, is a very smart animal, but more patient than the other three. The chimpanzee is very volatile, very emotional, gets upset. If they want to open a box and they cannot open it, they get extremely mad, which an orangutan would not do. An orangutan would just sit around and wait and sit it out. And so temperamentally, the animals are very different, and the bonobo has a calmer temperament than the chimpanzee. The bonobo has a friendlier disposition and a calmer temperament and doesn't get as excited as a chimpanzee gets about things. But in terms of intelligence, I would rate them at the same level, and some people rate them actually higher than the chimpanzee. Robert Yerkes, who had a bonobo without even knowing it, that was before the species was discovered, Robert Yerkes had one individual who he called Prince Chim, and which we now know was a bonobo. And he would write. He wrote a whole book about Prince Chim and called him an anthropoid genius. So he certainly believed he had a very special and very smart animal there.
Well, you mentioned earlier that one, the bonobo really kind of went counter to the scientific world's, you know, accepted view of the relationship and similarities between people and primates, mm-hmm. and also that they seem to be a lot fewer in number. Are those reasons why we don't know more about them and don't see more of them in zoos and other settings like that?
Yeah, the reason is partly they were discovered very late as a separate species, so people didn't pay attention to the differences at the time. They live in an area in Africa that has rampant warfare going on, which is the Democratic Republic of the Congo, and so the field workers have not been able to go there on a regular basis for now 15 years or so, and they started very late anyway. And then there's only, as I say, 150 bonobos in captivity, and we cannot import. There are restrictions now on importation of animals, obviously, from places like Africa and the tropics in general. And so even if people wanted to have more bonobos, that's not a possibility at this point because we have restrictions on import that we did not have like 30 years ago, but at that time people didn't see the value of bonobos.
Have they had any luck breeding them in captivity?
Oh, yeah, they breed very well. That's not a problem. There are also sanctuaries in Africa where we have bonobos that are confiscated at markets and so on where they're breeding them. And so I think in that sense everything is going well, but the captive population is very small.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
All right, thank you. And again, we have maybe about 10, 11, 12 minutes, something like that, left in this part of the show, talking with Franz de Waal. If you have questions, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. We've talked about the fact that you can look at both human beings and these two other species that are close to us in many ways and see examples of different kinds of behaviors, competition, cooperation, aggressiveness, gentleness, that those are certainly things that we're capable of, all of those these things, and that the two species, there are sort of characteristic patterns that they show. Are there Are there other things, you think, interesting things that you see these animals do that human beings also do that might tell you something about what is fundamental in human beings?
Yeah, there's so many things. For example, one item that I emphasize is our striving for power. That's an area, actually, that the social sciences tend to ignore. I'm a biologist who works in a psychology department, and I always look at the social psychology textbooks, and they barely ever talk about power and dominance. Whereas as a primatologist, obviously, I always see power and dominance as sort of the first thing I actually see in a primate group. And the striving for power, the making of coalitions to achieve power, the perks of power, and also the frustration when you lose it, all of that is visible in the human species very clearly. It's very clearly visible in Washington, but it's also very clearly visible in any environment, within the university, within schools, within corporations. And so these power structures fascinate me, and in that sense we have an enormous amount in common with the other primates.
Let's talk with some other callers here. Champagne is next. This would be line number one. Hello.
Hi.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to thank you for your book. I enjoyed it greatly. And I have a question about, has there ever been any interbreeding between chimps and bonobos that you've studied? And is it physically possible? And has it been tried? And what's the result, if it has?
Yeah, there's actually a report on it. I have never seen the creature that is the hybrid, but there is apparently a small circus in France that used to have chimpanzees for performances, and then they added what they thought was a chimpanzee, but it happened to be a bonobo male, and they now have several hybrids at the circus. And there are people studying them to compare them. The thing is, of course, that many people sometimes think that species cannot interbreed, but species can. You can, for example, interbreed a lion and a tiger, and in the same way you can interbreed a chimpanzee and a bonobo. In the field, they would never do that because there's a big river between the two. There's a river that is 10 miles wide at some points between the areas where bonobos live and chimpanzees live, so it would never happen. But they are capable of interbreeding, and I wouldn't be surprised if the offspring is even fertile, but we don't know that at this point.
And behaviorally, you can't say much about, because in a way that would start at least giving us some ideas about some of the questions that you didn't like, the word instinct. And,
mm-hmm.
And similarly, could you have a chimp baby brought up by bonobos? I mean, all those sorts of things are just questions that I'm wondering about based on reading and hearing you.
Yeah, the thing is that, of course, raising a bonobo baby in a chimp group would be possible, or the other way around. Zoos would generally like to avoid that. The thing is that bonobos are highly endangered, and chimpanzees are certainly threatened. And that kind of species you certainly don't want to start playing around with. And so we're not doing that. But all of these questions, yeah, would be very interesting to have, for example, a bonobo raised in a chimp group. Would the bonobo become more aggressive as a result, for example?
Mm. Okay, yeah. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. And we will go on. And the next caller is in Savoy, line number two.
Yeah, hi, how you doing? Mm-hmm. Hey, you know, this is a real interesting. I was wondering what your comments are. You know, there's actually been a movie, you know, where people actually think that they can make friends with, you know, like with a grizzly bear, and they find out that hey, they're actually grizzly bears. And yeah, I was wondering if there's, you know, but you know, I can understand how closely related, you know, like a 600-pound gorilla might be to us, but you know, how far do people take these relationships and then find out that they're wrong?
Well, that's always the problem, is that people underestimate the distance. So, for example, you may have heard of this recent case of a man who was visiting a chimpanzee who he had as a pet chimpanzee in California in a sanctuary, and he got attacked by two male chimpanzees who beat him so badly that he's still in critical condition in the hospital, and it's now almost a year later. So, people sometimes think they can get along with the animals, and then they underestimate that. And apes always remain dangerous.
Yeah.
Not as dangerous, I would say, as a grizzly bear, but
they're not that dangerous.
Well, we never go in with apes, that's for sure.
Okay, yeah.
So even the friendliest thing, even if they would slap you on your back in play, can be extremely painful. So we don't want to take any risks like that.
Okay. Yeah, I was just wondering, you know, like if they're, you know, like how far that distinction went, because, you know, it's whenever, you know, like up in Alaska, you know, you don't dare go anywhere without a, you know, without, you don't go, you even go fishing without some protection.
No, there are people who have apes at home. I think they make the worst pets possible. The same is true actually for monkeys also, because they have their own way of thinking about the hierarchy, and if they feel that they can beat you, they will.
Okay.
And so there's an enormous amount of danger, and some people manage to live for 20 years with an ape without any problems, but most cases that I know, it ends badly. And,
okay.
And they end up locking up the animal and all of that.
Yeah. Okay, I was curious about that.
Yep.
Done. Well, right. Thanks for the call. Let's do one more. We'll go to Indiana, line number 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hi, I just, thanks for taking my call, and I wanted to make a statement about the consciousness of humans as opposed to some of these other species, and that the leap that humans have made in some ways makes us, in some ways makes chimpanzees more closely related to bananas than they are to humans, although you might not be able to biologically differentiate that. And secondly, and similarly, that behaviors that lower animals might exhibit, such as homosexuality, as you describe it in the bonobos, may arise more out of the hardware components of their structures of their brains, whereas in humans they may arise more out of the software that has developed over the many years since we split off that tree. And I would appreciate your comments on that.
Yeah, I'm usually assuming that if we behave similarly to an ape, let's say we have power politics in which we form coalitions and which I do favors for those who do me favors, that's our power politic structure. And chimpanzees have the same sort of coalitions, and they do each other's favor after they have won the position of dominant male and so on. If we see behavior that is so extremely similar, my assumption is always that the psychology behind it must be similar too. That's a sort of the parsimonious Darwinian assumption. And anyone who wants to believe that if, let's say, bonobos have homosexual behavior and we have homosexual behavior, and that there's a vast gulf of difference between the two, will have to come with evidence to me. So the burden of proof is on those who want to make those sharp distinctions, I think.
What about this? This is a more difficult and more interesting question about consciousness, because that gets you into the question of, well, what exactly do you mean by that? What is it? And what?
That's always my problem. If people ask me, do you think chimps or bonobos are conscious? I say, if you tell me what consciousness is, I'll tell you whether they have it. And that's usually the end of the discussion, because no one knows exactly how, from the exterior, I can recognize that.
Mm-hmm. It does it have something to do with the individual's sense of themselves as an individual?
Well, we do have tests for that. For self-awareness, we have the mirror test. And, of course, we know that the apes pass the mirror test and the monkeys don't. And actually, basically, no other animal except for the dolphin passes the mirror test. So the mirror test tests whether you can recognize yourself in the mirror. And in that sense, the apes are definitely close to us, because they pass the test which most other animals don't. But that's only one expression of self-consciousness. There's so many other things that we don't know, and I would never want to make a strong claim on whether they have consciousness, yes or no, because I really don't know exactly what it is.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think we'll have to stop there. The book is very interesting, and I would suggest that people take a look at it. It's titled Our Inner Ape by our guest Franz de Waal. It's just one of his books. He's quite well known for his work on the social intelligence of primates. He is the C.H. Chandler Professor in the Psychology Department at Emory University. That's in Atlanta. He's also director of the Living Links Center at the Yerkes Primate Center in Atlanta. And Dr. De Waal, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus 580 archives. Much of our local production, including interviews from Focus and the Afternoon Magazine, as well as local news features, is available on our website anytime you want to listen. Just go to WILL.UIUC.EDU. I'm David Inge. Thanks for tuning in.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from St. John's Catholic Newman Center at the University of Illinois. Serving over 10,000 Catholic students, St. John's is dedicated to the spiritual needs and development of students, faculty, and staff at UIUC and Parkland College. Learn more on the web at sjcnc.org.
It's 2.5 minutes before noon Central Time. Make that 2 minutes before noon Central Time. 83 degrees in Urbana. Good morning. I'm Celeste Quinn. Coming up on the Afternoon Magazine today, we'll take a look back at the 2006 midterm elections and talk about how the Democrats, led by Illinois Representative Rahm Emanuel, won control of Congress. Our guest will be Chicago Tribune reporter Neftali Ben-David. Ben-David is the author of the new book, The Thumpin', How Rahm Emanuel and the Democrats Learned to Be Ruthless and Ended the Republican Revolution. We'll talk with Ben-David at 1:06. That's following the 1 o'clock news. Let's turn our attention now to what's happening with the commodity markets in Kansas City. July wheat is trading at 6.01, up 3. September, 5.93, up 2.25. July wheat in Chicago, trading at 5.95, up 6.5. September, 6.04.25, up 4.75. December, 6.18, up 5. July corn, 3.38.25, up 5.75. September, 3.46.25, up 7. December, 3.58, up 7.75. December, 08.402, up 5.5. July beans, 882.5, up 12.5. August, 887.75, up 12.25. September, 897.5, up 12.5. November, 915, up 13. July meal, 241 even, up 410. July oil, 37.54, up 22. At the Mercantile Exchange in Chicago, August feeder cattle, 113.77.5, that down 70 cents. August live cattle, 92.25, down 27.5. October, 96.77.5, down 40. July lean hogs up a nickel at 70